Hey guys. Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Check, check, check. Levels, levels, levels. I think I'll turn them up a little bit. Should be a good show for you. Got John Neffel coming on. He wrote up a thing about the ongoing drone wars for Rolling Stone. You might have forgot Barack Obama, as he says, is very good at killing people. And that's all over the world. He kills them. So, it'd be good to have John Neffel remind us a little bit about the drone war. Also, Peter Van Buren, who used to be a State Department guy tasked with rebuilding Iraq, who wrote a book called We Meant Well. He's going to be on. He wrote a thing for the Huffington Post about 10 reasons to just stay out of Iraq. There's another one that could be a pundit on TV if they would have him. Somebody knows something about it. Someone who's got citable credentials. But nope, they've got to keep the argument between invade this much or that much. I actually started watching the clip of Jon Stewart last night attacking Dick Cheney, but I turned it off at the point where, you know, I missed it. I didn't watch the end of it. Maybe he got to the real point in there somewhere. But it seemed like, hey, if Obama says 300 troops is the benchmark, and the right-wingers attack him for that not being enough, then that's enough. And then the question of whether America ought to be intervening over there at all, meh. Doesn't even really fit into the debate as portrayed, even on The Daily Show, which typically would be able to see a little bit broader than, you know, the view of the average CNN producer. And I know, I mean, they're all corrupt and paid to be that way, but they also believe in it. That's the problem. It's that propaganda model, as Noam Chomsky described it, where mostly just because of time reasons between commercial breaks, there's never any time for someone to really challenge the premise. And so there will be a vigorous debate. He's talking especially about cable TV news. There will be a vigorous debate within a very narrow margin of opinion with all of the mostly ridiculous assumptions undermining all positions or both positions remaining unchallenged throughout. So, should Benjamin Netanyahu murder every last person on the West Bank and take it? Or should he, you know, kill them slowly and pretend to call it the peace process and blah, blah, blah? Okay, that's not that narrow. It's pretty narrow from my point of view. That's, you know, I'm not a very good example, but you know what I mean. Should Obama send 300 troops or should he send 3,000 troops? Not, is this all America's fault? And is it possible that our government could do anything but make matters worse and et cetera, et cetera? I just don't want to hear that. Doesn't fit within their goalposts. And so, what's funny is the ability of the people in the media and, you know, the whole political class to really convince themselves of, you know, the legitimacy of opinions, the ones that may be entertained inside, you know, the political policy debate kind of process, how, you know, their own game for keeping unacceptable opinions out defines, even to them, in a perpetual motion machine kind of a way, what's acceptable and what's not. You know? If the Republicans and the Democrats are only having this argument, then that's the only argument to have. Right? Who in 2011 on TV, other than me, maybe, said, and only had a chance once, you got no right to attack Libya. You got no right. The only question is Obama taking too long to start the war against Libya? Is Obama taking too long to launch the surge of troops into Iraq? Or is he taking the right amount of time to launch the surge of troops into Iraq? It's the same crap. Anyway, that's just a long way of telling you Peter Van Buren's going to be on the show. Tomorrow, I'm going to talk with Michael Clare about this new piece in Tom Dispatch. I'll also be running at antiwar.com tomorrow about the oil. And it's not about, oh, yeah, the whole war was just about Houston trying to steal all their oil or something like that, which isn't true and was not what the war was about. But it's not what he's trying to say either. But he is trying to say that it's a major part of why the Sunni and Shia political leadership cannot get along, because they don't want to share that money. And really, you know what? That's what Juan Cole was saying on this show ever since back in 2004. And I quit listening to him about anything after he was for the war in Libya in 2011, because how unforgivably horrible is that? I don't know. I guess I forgave Lande for being for it. I don't know. I like Lande better. Anyway, Juan Cole always said, listen, the Sunni are going to fight like hell, not just to keep the capital city and the power, but especially because even if the country's to break apart, the Shia in the south and the Kurds in the north have their own oil. The Sunnis in the center of the country, in the west of the country, don't have that much of oil resources. And so they need a strong national government, preferably controlled by them, to make sure that they keep getting the revenues. If there's even strong federalism, they'll end up getting frozen out. And that's a lot of what Michael Clare describes. I always confuse Michael Clare and Michael Schwartz. They're both named Michael, and they both write for Tom Dispatch. It's Schwartz, not Claire. I even wrote Claire in my damn notes. Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z. That's the most letter-having way of spelling Schwartz that exists. There are a few. All right. Yeah, Michael Schwartz, a professor from Stony Brook. Smart stuff, good stuff. And it's not, oh, blood for oil, boo-hoo-hoo, stupid liberal uninformed nonsense. Houston, in the form of James Baker III, was sort of kind of in on the Iraq War, but not really. It was really the neocons' war. And James Baker, I believe this quote for whatever reason. It rings true to me, as reported by Max Blumenthal's father, Sidney Blumenthal, in an article at Salon.com, that James Baker told his friend, oh, I told him not to do that, when Bush gave his big 48-hour speech. Saddam, you have 48 hours to leave the country. We're invading either way, he announced. And that just rings true to me that Baker went, oh, man. You know, because the father, Brent Scowcroft, had written in the Wall Street Journal not to do it. It was pretty clear that, you know, Powell was reluctant, but of course went along. But anyway. So it wasn't about, you know, like a lot of liberals just assume, oh, evil Republican capitalists just want to take the oil and make evil, greedy profits. No, no, no. This is more about what Ariel Sharon wanted than anything else. Ask Richard Pearl. He'll deny it, and that's how you'll know it's a fact. And anyway. And of course, there was a fight, and this is what I want to talk with Michael Schwartz about in part. It doesn't make it into his article, but there was a discrepancy there between the different kinds of Republicans about what to do with Iraq. The Baker guys wanted regime change. They just wanted to basically replace Saddam with the next mustache in line. You know, like that's what Greg Palast said, like Al Dorey, somebody like that. The next Baathist who would maintain the status quo, would keep the Shia majority down, would keep the Kurds down, and would run a strong central government, a Sunni Baathist central government out of Baghdad. And that would be the way it would go. Whereas the neocons wanted to, I guess I'm blowing the whole interview here, I don't know. The neocons wanted to sell off Iraqi oil, like parcels of land, with, you know, oil land, in such small pieces to anyone. They wanted to open up the market to anyone in the world, even the Chinese and the French and whoever, to try to overproduce all of that oil and drive the price way down to break the Saudis, because that was an interest of Ariel Sharon's, was to, well, and of America imperialists too, some of them, to break Saudi control over OPEC. But then James Baker came in and insisted that that be stopped, as Greg Palast reported it back in 04 and 05. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you write all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction.
Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, Grant Smith is going to be on the show too, which is cool because I ain't talked with him in a little while. He's got a great one running on antiwar.com today. I wish I'd thought of inviting him earlier or to save myself a lot of stress over who the hell I was going to get on the show today. But now I got three good ones lined up. Grant Smith, John Neffel, and Peter Van Buren. All right, good. Now, so I got a ton of news to talk about, and I'm going to try. I should never say this because I always jinx it. I'm going to try to keep the lecturing and over-explanation to a minimum and just cover the news here. There's so much news going on here. And first of all, I wanted to refer you back to this article by Robert Dreyfus from December 4th, 2006. And this will help explain a lot. And there are a lot of articles by Dreyfus that explain a lot. And you know what? I really should be reading his blog at The Nation every day. The guy's really smart. Yes, he's a former LaRouche and a Democrat liberal type, but I don't give a damn. He's awesome on Iraq issues, man. He just knows exactly what the hell he's talking about. And he's proven it for a decade straight to me anyway. Okay, so this article is from December 4th, 2006, and you can't even find it except reprinted other places now because TomPaine.com, unfortunately, no longer exists. It's now just some Democrat think tank or some crap. But you can find the article reprinted in a few different, you know, forums and places around the internet. It's called Bush's Meeting with a Murderer. Bush's Meeting with a Murderer. And it begins, President George W. Bush meets today with Abdel Aziz al-Hakim, the turbaned leader of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Hakim, who was virtually FedExed into Iraq by the Pentagon in March 03, was a mainstay of the Iraqi National Congress, led by neoconservative darling Ahmed Chalabi through the 90s. And today, al-Hakim controls the Skiri militia, the Bada Brigade, the Iraqi Interior Ministry, and many of Iraq's feared death squads. Not to put too fine a point on it, Hakim is a mass murderer. And now, so here's the deal about this. And I know I explain this all the time, but, you know, I don't know. It's not quite breaking into the mainstream sort of narrative about what's going on here. But from the moment the Bush invaded in 2003... the Iraqi expats who'd been living in Iran came home. The Shia are the majority of the country, 60% Shia Arabs, 20% Sunni Arabs, 20% Kurds in the north who are Sunnis, but who are a different ethnicity, and in this case were equally oppressed by Saddam and the Sunni minority, and so they were in alliance with the Shia for the whole war and still to this day, since 2003. But so, in other words, another part of the story is that Chalabi was an Iranian spy. At least, that's what the CIA and the DIA later concluded, and it makes perfect sense to me, considering how Iraqi National Congress headquarters was in Tehran. There's a great article called How Chalabi Conned the Neocons, and it's about how Wolfowitz and Pearl and Libby and these guys were the stupidest idiots on the face of the earth. They were the marks for the Iranians, who told them, yeah, if you get rid of Saddam, it'll be the best thing that ever happened to Israel. Oh, and also, it'll put all this pressure on Iran to become democratic, just like Iraq. And then you know how democracies are. They all vote first thing to become best friends of America. And so Richard Pearl and his buddies, they bought into this nonsense. But really, the whole thing was an Iranian plot to lie the American people into war to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And yes, Ariel Sharon thought it was a good idea too, and George Bush thought it was a good idea too, and they were all really stupid and wrong. But so then what happened was they fought the whole war for the Bada Brigade. The Iraqi army, that's the Bada Brigade. When they were training up the Iraqi army, that was the Bada Brigade. That means giving them American uniforms and putting them through American drills, but they're already the Bada Brigade. They're already been trained by the Iranians all along. And you might remember when they fought the Shia, the only Shia faction that they fought was Muqtada al-Sadr. And Sadr was the guy who was anti-Iran and anti-United States. And they sided with the guys who were pro-Iran because they were pro-United States too. But of course, they were playing the Republicans all along. And when Bush said, give me 56 bases in the spring of 08, they said no. And he said, give me 60 bases, give me 40 bases, and they said no. And he said, give me 30 bases, and they said no. And then he said, give me no bases at all. And they said, okay. And then his time was up. He had to go. He had to sign the deal, the Status of Forces Agreement. So the Sunni resistance to the occupation all along fought the Americans to a standstill. And then the guys that the Americans fought the war for said, thanks for giving us the capital city. Now don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. That was the great success of the surge. The guys that America fought the war for then said, now go to hell. And the one Shia leader who was interested in really creating a government of national unity with the Sunni Iraqis was Sadr, who the Americans accused of being an Iranian stooge when he was the least Iranian of all the Shiite leaders, the least Iranian loyal of all the Shiite leaders. Just because he wanted the Americans out just as bad as he wanted the Iranians out. And so, in other words, this current situation is all George W. Bush's fault, from the invasion through every bit of how they carried it out. And, you know, really, you could argue that there's nothing he could have done about it, even if they had not debothified the government, even if they had not disbanded the Iraqi army. When the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani said, I want my people to have one man, one vote, and you're going to give it to them, George Bush had no choice other than start the war all over again against the Shiite South and the people, the Badr Brigade that they'd been putting in power, and the people who had stood aside and welcomed the invasion because, okay, go ahead and get, I mean, not really welcomed it, but go ahead and get rid of Saddam for us, and then we'll see, was the attitude of the people of the Shiite South for the most part. Because of all the promises of democracy and everything, they couldn't imagine they would be that full of it, you know? And when they said, give us one man, one vote, at that point, what are you going to do? Cut and run? What are you going to do? Admit that the Iranians fooled you into getting rid of Saddam for them? So what did George Bush do? He finished the mission. He surged in there to finish the mission, which was to put Iran's guys in power in Baghdad, the guys from the Supreme Islamic Council and from the Dawa Party. And so that's why everything is the way it is today. Just so you know, go read this great article, Bush's Meeting with a Murderer, all about George W. Bush and his best buddy, Abdelaziz al-Hakim, who's now dead. It's his son is running scary now, but same difference. There you go. And now, it's interesting that I keep bringing this up, and God dang, I talk too long, man, in spite of my promises. I keep bringing this up, and I'm not trying to say anything positive about Israel at all. I'm only pointing out the irony of the fact that there are so many Israel-first traitors in the American government who are so fixated on bringing down Assad in Damascus, the Shiite, sort of, you know, Alawite, Baathist tyrant of Syria, secularist government leader, dictator of Syria. They're so hell-bent on bringing him down because that's what Israel wants, that they can't admit that his war is with ISIS. Otherwise, their narrative would be simple and clean enough that we'd be launching a major war right now. Isn't that hilarious? The treachery of the Americans is actually keeping the war at a 102 fever instead of 110.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I screwed up. I sent my contact request too late. Now I'm going to have to make a phone call. Jeez. Hang on one sec, guys. I'll be right back.
How can you shoot women? Children?
Easy. You just don't need them so much. Ain't war hell?
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? So Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
Well, by identifying those people who are on our side, we can identify who these people are. We can help the right people.
All right, guys. Sorry about the mess there. Boy, can I not dial a phone and dial sound bites at the same time, it turns out. Isn't that a great quote of Hillary Clinton saying, listen, Zawahiri and Hamas support this rebellion in Syria. How are we supposed to get in on that? And, you know, when we look among the opposition for who do we have that we can back here, we just don't see anybody. That's back 2 years ago. Are we backing Al-Qaeda in Syria? She asked rhetorically. Yes, you are. You're guilty. Go directly to prison. Okay, sorry. Our first guest on the show today is our good friend Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me back once again.
Good. Yeah, very happy to have you here. And let me see. I'm trying to pull up your bio so I can say the name of some of your books. Here, the latest is Divert, Numek, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program. Oh, yeah. That's the Institute for Research Middle East Policy at IRMEP.org. And that's the subject of this article today, running at antiwar.com. It's called Death of the Masked Man, about a CIA officer named John Haddon. Who was John Haddon?
John Haddon was the CIA's Tel Aviv station chief back during the Six-Day War in 1967. The reason he's important, particularly today, as a number of other events are coming to pass, is that he was very much trying to get the Israelis not to engage in a sneak attack on Egypt's forces in the Sinai.
Hey, now let me stop you for just a second, Grant. Your phone sounds terrible. Is there a way? Can you see your Skype from where you are? Can you add me as a contact and we can try that?
Absolutely.
I think physically the microphone on your phone is of low quality, so it's really just distorting terribly on us here, and I'd hate to have the whole interview ruined like that. But as soon as you accept my contact request, I will call you on Skype.
Okay, well, hang on. I just pulled my mic. Is this better?
Actually, yeah, that is a bit better.
Okay.
Oh, were you on headset? Yeah. You were on a headset? Is that it?
I was guilty as charged. Just on a headset. I was on a $6 headset.
No headsets allowed.
All right, sorry.
No, it's all right. I don't care. Start over, and then that way we can edit out all this crap, and the interview will sound good.
Good, okay. Well, he was a CIA station chief in Tel Aviv during the Six-Day War, and he has, he passed away last year almost unnoticed by any journalist, except for his local newspaper up in Maine. And so it was very interesting looking around at all the material. He was outspoken for a CIA guy, particularly one in such sensitive positions.
but he had been summoned by the head of the Mossad in 67 before the war, and he was very blunt telling the Israelis that not only should they not attack, but that if they did, both Russia and the United States would be opposing them, and stood up in a way that was uncharacteristic of the way most U.S. politicians and State Department and government people stand up. You know, he had suggested that, kind of like in the Suez crisis a decade before, that the U.S. position was they should not attack and that U.S. aid might be on the line if they did, and not to surprise the U.S. So it's interesting because none of this is mentioned or was mentioned in his bio, excuse me, his obituary, along with a lot of other very interesting confrontations that he had with Israeli intelligence. So one of the interesting things about what actually happened that his son transcribed from a series of interviews, and I believe he published them only posthumously, was that during the Six-Day War, someone had called from LBJ's CIA on a weekend and tried to convince Haddon that he should authorize or tell the Mossad that the U.S. was okay if they took some sort of drastic action, and realizing that this is probably some junior political appointee, Haddon just dropped that into the shredder and said that there were many such moments in his career where he was on the spot like that. So that was a very interesting quote from his son, who took some 20 hours of taped interviews of his somewhat reluctant father about, you know, 10 years ago, but only coming out now. So why is it important now? I think it's important now because there's another spy who's just receiving dozens of obituaries. And it was a guy that John Haddon really went up against as part of someone's job pursuing U.S. interests and trying to rein in the Israelis, and that was Avraham Shalom. Shalom's name formerly was Avraham Bender, and his glowing obituaries talk about how he accompanied Rafi Eitan to kidnap Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires and bring him to Israel for a trial for war crimes. He was a Nazi. But they don't mention the fact that the same Avraham Bender, who later became somewhat critical of Israel's treatment of Palestinians, that he was also one of the team that went into this plant that we've talked about before, NUMEC in Pennsylvania, to help steal weapons-grade uranium. So you've got all these accolades and sort of glowing obituaries about Shalom, nothing about Haddon, and all of Shalom, a.k.a. Bender's actions targeting the U.S. have been edited out. So I found that very interesting, and kind of tried to contrast the two obituaries and histories in this article.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so there's a lot to go back over there, a lot of interesting stuff. First of all, 1967, well, geez, Israel had to defend themselves because the Arabs were trying to push them into the sea. What's in controversy about that?
Well, you know, I know you're laying out the bait there, Scott, but virtually all of the historians that come on your show, the ones who actually know something about the event, no longer even call it a preemptive or preventive war, since the Egyptians really showed no sign or means to attack, even though, you know, some of them were ragtag members or massed on the border. It now looks more and more like a sneak attack that was engaged in to accomplish some of the things that Israel did accomplish, which was territory.
We'll be right back with Grant F. Smith from IRMEP in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all. Welcome back. Oh, my, how time flies. Let's see here. Got to get back to Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. Boy, oh boy, is that a website full of PDFs of FOIA documents about Israel's policy in the United States of America going back generations. Grant F. Smith. That's why it's called the Institute for Research. It ain't just a nice name, it's apt. And so, yeah, we're talking about, and we're going to get to Israeli nuclear smuggling and the rest of that in just a second here. But we're talking about this article that Grant wrote that's running at antiwar.com today, Death of the Masked Man. Oh, Death of the Masked Men. CIA's John Haddon ignored as Israeli spy Avraham Ben-Dor celebrated. And so part of this story is about the death of this CIA guy and how all the obituaries, if there were any, didn't really make any mention of all the great things that he'd done, which most of which were, I guess, trying to thwart the Israelis. And so where we were interrupted at the break was the part where Israel started the 1967 war. And I'll just go ahead and mention here real quick. I got the full quote in context here from the Israel Ministry of Foreign Affairs. That's mfa.gov.il is the whole thing from an Israeli government website. The speech from August 8th, 1982 by Prime Minister Begin at the National Defense College, where he admits that, we just decided to attack Egypt, and no, there's no real evidence that they were going to attack us. We just decided that we wanted to, and so there you go, no point lying about it. So that's what we were talking about. But then so it gets all anecdote-y because this guy Haddon was there and told them, hey, don't do it. America's and Russia both will agree that we're going to be pissed off at you if you attack Egypt. And then they went ahead and did it anyway. Is that right, Grant?
That's right. There's more detail that I didn't write about, which was, you know, you had one of the Egyptian government officials traveling to Washington to try and, you know, iron things out. When he finds out that the attack has begun. So, you know, yeah, you've got definitely got the money quote there. And it really destroys some of your other guests have mentioned the whole case for preventive or preemptive war is in some case tied to the mythology of the 1967 Six-Day War. So right. It's really under attack by the facts, but the fact that this person in charge with the highest intelligence post in country was communicating what he thought were the marching orders, and he was being end-runned and also fed kind of bogus operations instructions from the CIA on weekends is interesting detail about the environment over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, too, about... The anecdote there, I don't know if there's much more to elaborate on there, but what you mentioned about him getting instructions on the weekend from some political appointee flunky over at CIA headquarters or somewhere telling him to give the Israelis carte blanche, basically, and he just refused to carry out the order. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, it's not clear from the transcription exactly what that action was. You know, you got to hope it wasn't, oh, why don't you use some of the nuclear weapons that we know you have? You got to hope it wasn't that. But it's definitely interesting that, according to him, you had what he referred to as gung-ho idiots at the CIA, pro-consuls basically, trying to get him to do something that not even the DCI wanted. So that's an interesting thing. The interesting thing about Haddon and the fact that, again, nobody did any obituaries except for one local newspaper was the fact that he was pretty vocal. It's not like there isn't a track record in LexisNexis that any journalist could have grabbed. He had this extensive interview with the BBC about this entire theft of uranium, and he never equivocated. He never backed down about his belief based on thousands of CIA documents, which have never been released, about how the same team that had nabbed Eichmann also nabbed all of this uranium. And the record is clear. There are actual letters which have been released showing the team going into the plant at the invitation of its operator when during the year of the highest loss. So it was interesting that he was so candid and so dismissive of the Israelis, comparing, you know, lifting all of this uranium is a much easier task than lifting the Nazi war criminal from the streets of Buenos Aires. And he was also didn't share much love with them. He mentioned them as a special case that, you know, he called them, they can go out and murder people and do all sorts of things we can't do. They get a lot done. And then he complained about their intelligence, saying Israeli intelligence is our main source of intelligence, unexamined, and that's another problem. So I found it oddly echoing a lot of the things that have come out in Jeff Stein's Newsweek profiles that have been, you know, circulating over the last couple of weeks about how this mistrust, this ongoing espionage, how it's affecting this drive to have visa-free entry and things like that. It seems as though that the basic sense hasn't changed very much. So, but, you know, comparing that to all of these loving biographies of one of the operatives who penetrated the plant, which is Avraham Bender, who changed his name to Avraham Shalom, is a real interesting thing, because these same American journalists who could do a credible job or could have done a credible job on what was essentially Bender's counterpart, if you look at the relative size of each country and its bureaucracies, they just neglected to do that. You've got, you know, basically behind the paywall over at the Jerusalem Post, there's a recent piece by their top national defense writer, Yossi Melman, basically admitting the truth of all of the nuclear diversions, including NUMEC. But, you know, it's just the fact that there's all of this fawning obituary and homages to this Shin Bet operative and John Haddon, the guy who basically exposed him publicly in the media, is utterly ignored is just astounding. But unfortunately, it's kind of typical. It's not something that, you know, readers of anti-war or other alternative news sites wouldn't expect.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true, but it's the public narrative that really matters, you know, the one that gets across there. And now, so it's interesting that it's the same guy who was the first to out what was going on at the NUMEC facility. Is that right?
He was, there were two CIA officials who came out publicly. One was Carl Duckett, who is the director of operations, who told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that it was the CIA's belief that a diversion had occurred. And John Haddon was the other one, who was the CIA Tel Aviv station chief. And presumably he would have been in charge of some of the sampling that took place outside of Dimona, which revealed the presence of weapons-grade uranium that matched the same signature of what was being given to this NUMEC facility to process into submarine fuel. So he was unequivocal in his condemnation of that when he discussed it with the press. The authority of these two insiders at the same time that the CIA, they were leaving the CIA, and at the same time the CIA was, and still does, it's fighting never to release any of its own multitude of files on the incident, but their credibility really helped carry this to a head in 1978-1979 as the Carter administration finally passed information to the attorney general and said, you know, basically we've either got to prosecute this or let it go, because now the statute of limitations is running out. So he played a role in underscoring the fact that something bad had happened just by his willingness to go public about it.
And now Zalman Shapiro still just lives in Philadelphia, is that right?
And yeah, he's not in trouble? He's still, No, he's not in trouble. He's not worried. He's still in Pittsburgh. Every once in a while, an intrepid reporter will call him up and say, okay, Zal, please, let's just, you know, let's admit everything. Why don't you tell your real story? Kind of the way Arnon Milchan recently admitted that he was also a nuclear spy.
Yeah, don't worry. You have immunity. Just go ahead and...
Well, you can pretty much say that.
Yeah.
We're
out of time, Grant. We got to run. Thank you, though, very much.
All right, good to talk to you again. Good to talk to you.
Check out Grant today at antiwar.com. Y'all, Death of the Masked Men. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all, welcome back. All right, so back to Iraq news. I got to say first, I guess, construct my own sort of theory about what's happening here. There's going to be a giant war. Like I was trying to point out the other day when Obama gave his statement. No, we don't want to have a, oh crap, what was the term? Not slippery slope, but a mission creep. No, we want to avoid mission creep. Our only goal is to prevent there from being a terrorist safe haven in Western Iraq and in Syria. Huh? You could fly the Vietnam War through that loophole. You could fly the first and second Gulf Wars through that loophole right there. No safe haven is how they justified staying in Iraq for years and years and years, is how they justified the surge in Iraq and in Afghanistan, making Afghanistan the longest war in American history by quite a bit. No safe haven when, as we all know, it was Egyptian graduate students in Hamburg who were the pilots on 9/11. They trained in flight schools in the United States. As James Bamford reports, they held one of their final meetings at a motel in Maryland just down the road from National Security Agency headquarters. Ramzi bin al-Shib met with Mohammed Atta on final details, I think with Atta, in Spain. Marwan al-Shehhi was going back and forth. Anyway, these guys were graduate students living in Western Europe. Afghanistan as safe haven had nothing to do with it. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was in Pakistan. Anyway, safe haven myth aside, they're going for it, it seems like. And when they talk about, I mean, all this talk for days and days and days has been that, well, we need, you know, maybe Maliki needs to be replaced by somebody who's willing to have a more inclusive government. I saw a headline the other day trying to take this seriously and to its conclusion. It's time to rebothify the government. Well, sorry, partners, that ship sailed years ago now. Years ago. Who the hell are you going to get in there that's going to do that? Even if they put Iyad Alawi back in there, he's not even going to be able to forge that kind of an alliance with the Sunnis of the former awakening and whatever. It's 2014 and a half right now. It's been years like this. And the goal all along, again, back to Dreyfus, the goal all along of the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party was just to take Baghdad and the areas to the south. The Iranians don't want the hassle of trying to occupy them and their proxies, don't want the hassle of trying to occupy all the Sunni areas forever, where they have no grassroots authority at all. That's why the army just melted away from Mosul, as they put it. I don't know who handed out the talking point, but everybody dropped their weapons and turned and ran. It's because it wasn't their territory. And so it was a fight they knew they couldn't win. So who wants to die fighting for land you can't win when you can get safe back behind the line? Again, back to the fight between Skiri and Sadr, between Badr and Sadr. They wanted federalism. He wanted nationalism. He wanted a government of unity with the Sunnis. They wanted, screw that, let's just have a civil war, take the capital city, we'll have the Americans, Army and Marine Corps die killing to take the capital city for us, and then we'll kick them the hell out, and we'll have Southern Arab Shiistan. That was the plan of the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party all along. And you can go back and listen to my interviews of people like Juan Cole and Bob Dreyfus and others going back to 2004 and 2005 explaining exactly that. So then when they surged in 2007, took on Sadr to no effect whatsoever, or they killed a lot of people and hardened a lot of Shiite ideas against them, where they had some allies among the Shia, they really alienated the hell out of everybody by attacking the Sadrists to no real end. He's still a part of the United Iraqi Alliance, or whatever they call it now, the Shiite Alliance party that controls the parliament. And then they had as their goal, the benchmarks, they're going to incorporate the leadership of the Sunnis, the former Ba'athists, the tribal leaders, the imams and whatever, their friends, and put them in power and share some power. And then they never did that. They never did that throughout the whole year 2007. And you might remember, I sure do, it was only, God, I can't believe how long ago that was now, 7 years ago now, 6, 7 years ago. I can't do arithmetic while I'm talking, but anyway. Petraeus was originally supposed to testify in September before the Congress about all the progress they were making on the benchmarks. And then they put it off to October. And by the time he testified in October, they didn't mention benchmarks anymore. The benchmarks, the measurements of success for the surge was supposed to be the degree to which the Shiites allowed the Sunnis to come back into power and compromise and share authority with them. And that didn't happen at all. It didn't happen in 2007. It didn't happen in 08 or 9 or 10 or 11 or all the way now. It's 14 and a half. And what's happening now is the Declaration of Independence of the East. And in fact, it's really too bad that this guy, James R. Holmes, ends his article at The Diplomat with a call to war in some circumstances, because otherwise this would be running at antiwar.com today. He's got one evil sentence in the whole article, but it's really important, I think, to read. It's called "In Iraq, ISIS Channels Mao." Unlike Al-Qaeda, ISIS seems to understand Mao Zedong's classic Phase 3 battlefield struggle. And of course, you know, Al-Qaeda's Zawahiri and bin Laden's agreement was that we gotta bog down the U.S., bleed them to bankruptcy, and force the American empire out. Only then will we be able to take on our local dictators when they're not backed by the global hegemon. And what he's saying is that that strategy of just terrorism and just trying to bait the U.S. and whatever, that that wasn't enough to really accomplish their goals. They should have, from their point of view, modified their goals. And so now look at what this guy, Omar Akbu, whatever the hell, Baghdadi has done since breaking away from Ayman al-Zawahiri, is he has gone ahead and started to try to consolidate a state, right? He's not pushing regime change in Damascus. So far, he's not pushing regime change in Baghdad. He's now, you know, expanded and created alliances with the Ba'athists and the others, the other Sunni tribal and religious leaders in northwestern Iraq. He's now a conservative. He's gone from radical to conservative. He's trying to consolidate the power that he's got. And this guy, again, it's James R. Holmes at The Diplomat, talks about, he cites Clausewitz as saying, you know, this guy is at the point of culminating, the culminating point of victory. Now, they would be fools to push it and try to take Baghdad. They'll end up losing the authority over the land that they've already conquered. So unless they're absolutely suicidally crazy, or maybe they just make a bad judgment call that by provoking a civil war with the Shia, that they will end up rallying more Sunnis to their banners, and that if they need to go through one more stage of civil war with the Shia in order to increase their power, which is a strategic or a tactical kind of decision, I don't know what you call it, that they could make. It seems like a bad idea to me from their point of view. But this is saying that these guys have learned from Mao, and they are going immediately. They're filling potholes. They're providing water and electricity far beyond what the corrupt government was providing before. and they are trying. They are cutting thieves' hands off and this kind of thing, too. They're instituting oppressive dress codes for women, and they're cracking down on some pretty bin Ladenite Sharia law here, and we'll see how much blowback they get from that. It really was counterproductive for their purposes back in 05 and 06, leading to the Iraqi Sunni tribal leaders to turn on them. So we'll see how far they push that, but so far they seem to be trying hard to maintain their gains. And so then the question is, I guess that we're waiting for is to see whether they blow it. But I don't think so. I mean, it's not like we're talking about, one group of Baathists trying to overthrow another group of Baathists in Syria, but everybody means to keep the lines where they are. These are people who don't give a damn about those lines other than trying to erase them. So if they can make a whole new Islamo-fascist caliphate, as Bush would have called it back when it was completely make-believe before he created it, somewhere in eastern Syria and northwestern Iraq, then fine. This is going to be a long time. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. Oops. All right. I'm writing a tweet and hosting a radio show at the same time, and yeah, I'm not good at that. All right, so yeah, I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horton Show, and I'm about to have to go to interviews, so let me move on with the news. I got so much news, and I'm so bad at portioning my news coverage. Well, we're going to get back to Iraq with Peter Van Buren coming up anyway, so let me move on here to the cops for a minute here. Remember the two-year-old who the cops, I think they said he was three, right? That makes him a little bit less innocent of a target or something by making him three instead of two. The two-year-old who the Atlanta cops damn near murdered with a flash bang grenade a few weeks ago, his mother has written an article for Salon.com. How often does that happen? I don't mean the SWAT raid hurting the small child. That happens all the time. But the mother then getting an article published like this. It's really something else. You can put yourself in this lady's position for one moment. A SWAT team blew a hole in my two-year-old son, she writes. That's right. Officers threw a flashbang grenade in my son's crib and left a hole in his chest. It gets worse. Of course, it was a drug raid over someone who wasn't even there, who was accused of selling a little bit of meth to some rat. The cops raided the house. They tried to kick down the door, but there was something blocking the door, so they threw a flashbang grenade in. It was the baby's crib that was blocking the door. The flashbang grenade blew up on the baby's pillow, damn near tore his face off, and blew a hole in his chest. She says that you can see his ribs through the hole in his chest. One of his lungs, they're saying, is inoperable. He's in a medically induced coma still. This is 3 weeks ago now, maybe more. And as she writes, these cops came in armed with M16s through the house like they were playing war, which is exactly what they're doing. Playing war. Bunch of pretend tough guys. The reason they dress up with twice as much armor as a Star Wars stormtrooper is because they're tiny little cowards. They're the most pathetic cowards in all of American society, obviously. kicking down people's doors. Yeah, they're real brave at 3 o'clock in the morning when they know they're going to catch you sleeping. And so, not only did they throw a grenade at the kid and damn near blow his face off and blow a hole through his lung, and he may die still. But then they threatened and verbally abused the parents. They lied about the baby, would not let them see their baby, lied and said, oh, he just lost a tooth, everything is fine, and threatened them. And they'll all get away with it, and you know it, and so do I. Not one of these cops is going to do prison time for this at all. And in fact, probably, I mean, relative to other stories just like this, maybe people care. But over the long haul, apparently nobody cares. Nobody cares. Yeah, occasionally the SWAT cops, you know, the local deputy sheriffs, occasionally they kick in our doors and throw grenades at our babies. But, you know, hey, we got to stop people from selling speed to each other. Now, pardon me, because I got to take my kid to the doctor because they've been prescribed amphetamines, right? So they can pay attention in government school. Got to take your Ritalin as long as you have a government-mandated doctor prescription from the fascist American Medical Association pill combine. But meanwhile, if some mullet-headed idiot wants to sell crank to another mullet-headed idiot, then baby's got to die. Oh, well, right? That's called conservatism. Let the babies burn. We have to keep people from selling meth to each other. Kill them all, right, conservatives? Isn't that what you believe? Don't worry, Jesus will take care of this little boy, right? When he gets up to heaven, it'll be okay. So anyway, there you go. Two-year-old son, they throw a flashbang at him. And you know how the prosecutors say, oh, come on, these are just a distraction device. It just makes a flash and a loud sound. Well, okay, fine. Go ahead then and put district attorneys in cribs and throw flashbangs at them until they're done proving what tough guys they are and how they don't mind it. I think you can fit a district attorney in a baby crib, you know, if you make him get in the fetal position there. They don't mind. It's sort of like Scalia said. This isn't torture. It's just enhanced interrogation techniques. Well, I guess he wouldn't mind if we use these techniques on him then. Someone enhanced interrogate Scalia and get back to me on whether he cried like a little baby or not. You know, one who wasn't in a medically induced coma in order to prevent him dying from the shock of being attacked with a flashbang by the local deputy sheriff sworn to protect him. So, anyway, I'm just tired of people believing that the cops are the American people in any way, that they're civilians like us, that they're humans like us. They're not. They are just the hired killers of the state. That's all they are. People still, to this day, in 2014, they call 911 in order to help each other. Are you crazy? Don't you even watch the local news? You're going to call the Nazi Gestapo stormtroopers of death to help your suicidal cousin or whatever? Are you out of your mind? They would just as soon kill you. Each and every cop is looking for a chance to kill someone. That's why they became cops. They want to kill someone. They're smart enough that they've thought it through and they don't want to go to prison. They want to have immunity, sovereign immunity from prosecution for any person that they kill. So they clock in and then they kill. This whole thing that they're our security force and that I'm the one with the radical interpretation has got to fall away now. You have got to get over it. And I don't care if your brother or your cousin or your friend or your father is a cop. You tell me then, the good cop that you know, how many other cops has he ever arrested in his life? Zero, exactly. Because your cop, friend, brother, nephew, cousin is also a criminal. If he hasn't murdered somebody himself, you know, for fun, He's helped be an accessory to the crime over and over again his entire career. And you know it. You know it. They're all guilty. Guilty. No exceptions. You show me where one cop arrested another cop for committing a crime. Give me a break. Here they are killing a mentally ill man at LibertyCrier.com with a hood over his head, strapped to a chair, suffocating him to death. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to The Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And hey, it worked out. I got John Neffel on the line.
Scott, how's it going?
Hey, John. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah. Glad to be back here.
All right, so the article is at Rolling Stone. The U.S. is still waging a forever war in Pakistan and Yemen. Two countries where, you know, I guess everybody takes it for granted that we're still bombing them all the time. But I admit I haven't even been paying much attention to either of those in at least a few weeks. I guess I was reading up on some Yemen strikes a few weeks back. But other than that, you got me. So thanks for keeping your eye on the ball here. Why don't you let us know what's up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm as guilty of this as anyone else. I mean, with the headlines in Iraq and ISIS sort of dominating everyone's attention, it's pretty easy to forget that these quieter wars are continuing. And one of the things that made it even easier to forget was that in Pakistan, the Obama administration and the CIA put the drone program there on pause back on Christmas Day. So there had been about a 5.5 month pause in these CIA-led drone strikes in Pakistan. And that ended a little bit over a week ago when we saw the program resume with three strikes targeting members of the Haqqani network and possibly targeting some Uzbekistan militants, which is important, and that's something that we can get to in a minute. And then the drone strikes in Yemen have continued at a sort of at a slow pace, but they've never really gone away, even though they have decreased in number since last year.
All right, and now can you talk a little bit about the attack at the Karachi airport?
Yeah, so the attack in Karachi, which was one of the major factors that led to the breakdown in peace talks between the Pakistani government and the Pakistani Taliban, was carried out by these Uzbekistan militants, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, in coordination with the Taliban in Pakistan. And what's really important about that is that the Pakistani government, as near as we can tell, had asked the CIA to stop drone strikes while the government conducted these peace talks with the Taliban. And once those peace talks fell apart after the deadly attack in Karachi that resulted in 36 people, including, I believe, 10 militants dying. Mm-hmm. It seems that the CIA either explicitly or implicitly got the go-ahead to go after some of the militants that they had been wanting to go after. Mm-hmm. And what's also really interesting about the timing is that the Haqqani Network was the group that had control of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl until very recently. And so some commentators were suggesting that now that Bergdahl wasn't being held by the Haqqani network anymore, that the CIA would feel a little bit freer to strike them because they didn't have an American that they could kill. But many people pointed out that, you know, Bergdahl has been a POW for about 5 years, and that over that time, the CIA certainly was not shy about striking militants in these tribal regions in Pakistan when they wanted to.
Right, yeah, that's definitely true. Well, it is funny, though, that, you know, Kerry and Rand Paul both, and I'm sure probably some others, talked about, well, maybe we'll just go ahead and do drone strikes against the five guys that they released from Pakistan. Right. Of all the no good, dirty, rotten double crosses, they don't even know how bad that sounds. Like, maybe we'll just kill these guys that we just made a deal for.
I know. You have to imagine that those kind of statements are going to make any future POW swaps more difficult. And those, I mean, the five guys that were released, at least one of them, there are very, very serious and very credible allegations that he's committed war crimes. But this idea that all five of those released from Guantanamo were high-level Taliban commanders who are going to all substantially change the reality, you know, quote-unquote, on the battlefield, that really doesn't play out. And when you look at the claims that the U.S. Intelligence agencies used to, you know, to justify detaining these guys, a lot of them really fall apart, and just some of these guys, in fact, I think most of them were actually double crossed when they in 2002, when they tried to surrender to U.S. forces or to Afghan forces, and instead of surrendering and you know, sort of being given a deal to work with, and they were instead sent to Guantanamo. So, right. So there's I think been a lot of you know, heightening of the threat that releasing those five guys sort of posed.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Anand Gopal wrote a thing for CNN, and I think there are some other articles too. But Anand really knew all about these guys' backstories and really debunked all the hype about it back a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and his book, I actually just finished reading his book, No Good Men Among the Living.
Oh, yeah, I have it right here, but I'm the worst.
I would really, really recommend all your listeners take a look at that if they want to actually learn what the Taliban actually is, what U.S.-backed warlords actually are, and what the occupation in Afghanistan actually looked like on the ground. It's a really, really amazing resource.
Yeah. I need to just get a chain and wear it around my neck until I finally get it done or something. I'm the worst about reading books nowadays. It sucks because I got so many great ones here, you know, beginning with that one to follow up on with these journalists. But anyway, so now what about the fact that America's had a drone war going on against the Pakistani Taliban for years now, which I guess was portrayed, at least originally, as sort of doing a favor to the Pakistanis as payback for them letting the Americans target Arabs hiding out in Afghanistan. So if you're going to do that, you got to target some Taliban leaders for us. But so how's that working out when the Karachi airport's being attacked and all this is going on? I mean, I have to admit, I'm trying to play devil's advocate a little bit here with my own self, that, like, hey, if this guy's a really bad Taliban enemy of the Pakistani government, and you hellfire missile him to death, well, he ain't alive anymore. Now, maybe you'll create 10 more, but maybe they won't be quite as bad as this terrible mastermind or whatever. It's within the realm of possibility is what I'm trying to say, that putting firepower on targets could destroy enemies, but it doesn't seem like there's any fewer of them or that they're any less capable than the prior generation.
Right. Well, and I mean, you're absolutely right in the way that you characterized the beginning of the program 10 years ago, which started when the Pakistani government wanted the U.S. to off this guy, Nek Mohammed, who was a local insurgent, basically. He had been declared an enemy of the state by the government, by the Pakistani government. And they said, you know what, CIA, we know that you want to fly these drones over our skies and take out some Al-Qaeda types. So we'll let you do that. We'll scratch your back if you scratch ours. And so this program in Pakistan began with what a human rights attorney that I talked to described as a bargain chip killing. And it's essentially, it's not that different from something that, you know, the mob might do, where somebody's giving you a hard time, so you off them, and then all of a sudden you curry favor with the host government. And so that's how this program started.
All right, now we're going to have to go out to this break, but when we get back, we'll talk with John a little bit more about what's going on with the drone war in Pakistan, and then on to Yemen, and maybe a little Somalia intervention as well. Again, it's John Neffel writing in Rolling Stone, three troubling lessons from the latest U.S. drone strikes.
In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous D.C. think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the line with John Neffel from Rolling Stone magazine. And we're talking about the drone wars in Pakistan and Yemen. And, well, there's so many damn wars going on. You got to limit the discussions to one region or another or two. Okay, so now I guess I need to let you talk about the drone war in Yemen and then also give you time to speak about your different conclusions that you've come to about what's going on here, which I think are quite astute and worth mentioning. So I guess, can you update us on the situation in Yemen, unless there was anything left untied about Pakistan you want to nail down before we go?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to add one other thought about Pakistan that ties into Yemen. So, you know, before the break, we were talking about the program starting by targeting this militant who wasn't a threat to the United States, but was an enemy of Pakistan. And that may have been the case in one of the three strikes that we've recently seen in Pakistan about a week ago. Some of the people I spoke with think that one of the strikes actually targeted Uzbek militants who were responsible for the attack on the airport in Karachi. And if that's true, that means that the United States is targeting enemies of the Pakistani government, but not people who are direct threats to the U.S., which would mean, that in some ways the United States is engaging in putting down a local insurgency, or perhaps less generously engaged in the sort of like low level civil war that's going on between, enemies of the government and the Pakistani government. And that's similar to what's happening in Yemen.
Now, let me interrupt you for just a sec to mention to people that it was the drone strikes against the Pakistani government's enemies in the Pakistani Taliban that drove Faisal Shahzad into joining up with the Taliban and attempting to blow up Times Square back in 2010. And he explained in court exactly why he did it. Here was a Pakistani American who was an American citizen, had a wife and a professional job and a good salary and a house and everything going for him. But when he went home to Pakistan to visit relatives, he saw the aftermath of a drone strike and joined up as a soldier on their side of the war. Simple as that. Almost blew up Times Square. And so I'm not saying in and of itself that makes none of this worth it or whatever, but it's something for people to keep in mind, and Brian Williams ain't going to bring it up, so I got to. Now, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is worth bringing it up. And it's something that, you know, as citizens, when our taxpayer dollars are being used to blow up people who don't pose any threat to the United States, is the country going to see blowback from that? And what we're seeing in Yemen is similar. One of the researchers from Human Rights Watch, who wrote a really amazing report last year on the drone wars in Yemen, told me that the United States is essentially functioning as the Yemeni government's air force in trying to put down this insurgency that's being led in part by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And so what you have certainly in Yemen and arguably in Pakistan is this sort of shift from attacking militants who have explicitly said they want to attack U.S. people on U.S. soil to militants who are attacking host governments. And I think that when you look at Obama's speech the other day on Iraq, he was actually saying something very similar. I mean, you could perhaps argue that the territory that ISIS has taken, you know, at some point in the future might pose a threat to the United States. You know, I think that's a reasonable point, if not one that I would agree with. But nobody has put forth any evidence that ISIS itself is at this point attempting to launch attacks on the United States. And so getting involved in what looks to be an increasingly like a civil war in Iraq might be the same kind of policies that we're already seeing in Yemen and Pakistan. And I think that, you know,
there is a real danger from ISIS. I think the fact that an American did a suicide attack there a few weeks back, and that a French veteran of ISIS killed two Jews at a museum in Brussels, I think a week before that, are the early indications that they are coming west. But I still think that's all the more reason to not get involved, because it's intervention for and against these kooks over there, against them, but accidentally for them under Bush, and then deliberately for them in Libya and Syria under Obama, that has got us to this. So non-intervention is still the best policy there, but I think that they are more dangerous than a lot of people realize. I think they probably think they could benefit from dragging us back into the war there, you know?
I think that is true. That last point I definitely agree with. And you see statements that ISIS has made where they have sort of been beating their chest and say, essentially, come at me to the United States. And so I think that, and if you look at where ISIS came from, which was a group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, their goal was not only to mire the U.S. in a civil war, but to kill Shiite Muslims. And so so ISIS's goal has long been just massive destabilization and civil war. I'm not entirely sure, though, that the extent to what to which they are a threat to the United States is entirely clear. I mean, we've been hearing the FBI talk about the threat that Syrian fighters, coming to the United States pose. And that's something that they've been talking about for at least a year, if not more. And when you actually look at the people who have been arrested and charged because they've wanted to go to Syria and come back, you actually see goofballs. You see, for the most part, most people who are being entrapped. And yeah. I mean, you know, for anyone out there who says somebody, there's a case in Long Island not too long ago, for anyone who says somebody in Long Island is going to go to Syria and get radicalized and come back and shoot up a mall, look, you don't have to go to Syria to shoot up a mall in the United States. Right. There are so many mass shootings in this country, and anyone who wants to wage violence against the United States, if they're already in the United States, I think has more than enough opportunity to do it. And that's just to say that we should, I think, when officials tell citizens that the threat from foreign fighters means that we should, turn the other way if our neighbors are entrapped, or that we should, you know, fear this group that really, I don't think, poses an imminent threat to the United States. I just think that those are claims we should be very, very skeptical before we take officials.
I'm only trying to look at it from the point of view of the strategic logic from their side of why they would want to maybe do things like that and some of
those. But anyway,
I won't argue about that with you, but I will now shut up and let you talk about Yemen, because we're running low on time and there's a lot to cover here.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, just a sort of final thought on Yemen is that at that same press conference that I was just talking about, where Obama was talking about Iraq, he pointed to Yemen as the sort of standard for what counterterrorism operations could look like. And he said, we want to pursue the Yemen model. Well, the Yemen model has been a complete failure. And when you look at activists in Yemen who responded to that press conference, they said what the United States is doing in Yemen is terrible policy. It's empowering a government that has barely any legitimacy. It's carrying out drone strikes that only make Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula more powerful and more sympathetic to the local population. And all of it happens in complete secrecy, with no oversight, with no accountability, and with no very few money or any sort of other reparations given to people whose family members are accidentally killed. And so I think that the fact that Obama is talking about Yemen as this model that should be pursued and replicated in other countries is incredibly troubling. And if that's what his goal is in Iraq, I think that that's just going to result in a terrible, terrible policy that's going to be completely secret.
Right. Well, and you can see the benefit from his point of view, like Bill Clinton bombing Serbia for miles in the sky, is it keeps Americans safe. And so why send in the 82nd Airborne and the 3rd Infantry Division, all this George W. Bushian madness, when you can just send fleets of Reaper drones? And so, and then you get to argue that at least you're killing people. From a Democrat point of view, that makes good politics, I guess. And I think you're right. You say this is what the at least near-term future of military force looks like. It's a sad story.
So you're a libertarian.
Oh. Whoops, I didn't realize how over time we were. Thanks very much for your time, John. Great to have you back on the show.
My pleasure.
All right, but that is John Neffel from Rolling Stone magazine. The article is 3 Troubling Lessons from the Latest U.S. Drone Strikes. Right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back. Come here, microphone. Where the hell are you going? Hey, guys, welcome back to the show. Peter Van Buren coming up to talk about the war in Iraq. Ah, the war in Iraq. Man, I don't know. I've always thought that I really regretted that I didn't do my very best. Not that it would have really made a difference, but that I didn't do my very best to just be full forces anti-Iraq war as I could possibly be all day, every day in 2002 and 2003. I could see it for the slow motion train wreck of dishonesty and decaying corpses it was destined to become just right off the bat. I was just lucky, I guess. I read William Sapphire in the New York Times, reprinted in the Austin American Statesman, right after September 11th. It was an article called The Big Mo, meaning momentum, which is, and what he said, and William Sapphire already knew, was very close to the war hawk neocon types. And he said, bin Laden, bin Schmaden, go after Iraq. The American people are with you. You can do whatever you want. Go after Iraq. That's the agenda. Everybody knows it. Everyone I'm talking to in D.C., his buddies, say that this is what has to be done next, et cetera, et cetera. It's just that clear. And I guess I actually did predict that kind of thing before Bush was even the president, that once Bush is president, we'll go to war with Iraq. Because you can't have him leave in the presidency, even the chance he could leave the presidency after 4 years with Saddam still in power, which is what happened to his father, to his everlasting shame. And so there had to be a war in Iraq, basically, as long as W was going to be the president, as simple as that, seemed like to me. But anyway, I'm looking at this kid in a pile of rubble. I forgot my point. Oh, Iraq. That I wish I'd somehow figured out a way to get my bills barely paid. Just, my standing policy. Just keep me barely alive and let me be anti-Iraq war all day. It's all I need to do for 2002 and 2003. And I've always regretted that. I tried to oppose in my own little way, my weekly radio show, little pirate radio show here in Austin, whatever. But now here we are, same position again. I've been trying to oppose all the different wars at the same time all day if I can. But here we are going back to Iraq, and the flaws in the logic of the policy stated by the president and his secretary of state, especially, reveal to my mind that, I think it's inevitable that they're talking about a major war there. Because these ISIS guys, I think, are Well, I just don't think politically that Obama will be able to withstand there actually being a real Sunni bin Ladenite jihadistan in northwestern Iraq and eastern Syria like this. He's just not going to be able to do it. And the only thing, like I said before, is crazy that this is a thing, and I don't know how long this can last. The only thing really preventing them from saying, all right, screw it, let's just go ahead and team up with the Iranians and the Shiite-backed Baathists in Syria against these bin Ladenites is treachery on the part of the entire Congress and the president on behalf of Israel. They're still so hell-bent on this old Ariel Sharonian policy of regime change against Assad that they just can't back off backing the rebels in Syria. They just can't change their damn policy, even in the face of all of this. Even when everyone knows now, it's getting through to the major narrative here that, yeah, America's support for the rebels is helping these ISIS guys. Even if they're not directly arming the ISIS guys, it doesn't matter. They get all the money and the weapons anyway. And even if they're only backing the FSA and the FSA is hurting Assad, well, Assad is the only thing keeping al-Qaeda down in the country. It ain't the FSA moderates keeping al-Qaeda down. It's Assad. So if it wasn't for this, you know, lowercase t treason on behalf of Israel in Washington, D.C., matters would be even worse because they wouldn't be, somewhat backing the jihadists to a stalemate war in Syria. They would be outright waging a full-scale war against jihadistan and on behalf of the Baathists. Of course, I'm not recommending any of these policies. I'm just drawing all the choices there. George Bush used to pay Bashar al-Assad to torture these guys to death. And now America supports them against him, even while they're the name of the reason of the excuse for further intervention in Iraq. It's out of control, dude. It's crazy. And I gotta say that I like Neffel's anti-war talking points, and I'm against the U.S. government's existence, so how in the hell could I support it doing anything to anyone? I don't support it doing anything to anyone, but I think I agree with some of the hawks about what a danger ISIS is. Now, they'll always kind of obfuscate about when and where and to who and that kind of thing, but I think ultimately they are really a threat, and I think that's the number one reason why to stop intervening over there immediately, you know? This is why terrorists are such a great enemy for the government to have. They love it because they don't have to really get into a fight with a state that's decisive in any period of time. They can just keep the thing going forever. And they're fighting against individuals, or at least, you know, groups that recruit individuals outside of state power. I mean, sometimes they're backed by states, but they're basically private organizations. So they're small and they're nimble and they're cheap and, William S. Lind calls it fourth generation war, and by that he means generation negative one. First generation war comes after the Treaty of Westphalia, and let's see, how do you describe it? Let's see, by the time you get to third generation war, so lining them all up in the field to fight like idiots, like back in colonial days and whatever, Napoleon days and all that, that's what they call first generation warfare. And then second-generation warfare is like the Nazi blitzkrieg and shock and awe and all that kind of thing. Attacking from all directions at once and on all different levels and that kind of thing. And then third-generation warfare, he says, is actually really just, you know, second-generation warfare, only bogged down occupying somebody's city, basically. World War I-style fighting. I'm screwing it up. I guess World War I was Generation 2, and then Shock and Awe is Generation 3. Yeah, that's what it was. And then, so occupying Iraq, that's back to Generation 2, World War I tactics and that kind of crap. And then, but when you get to Generation 4, he says it's actually Generation Negative 1. It's actually going back to stateless armies that are faith-based or crime-based and have no state loyalty or centrality to them. And that makes them a more dangerous threat in some ways. You know, like when Netanyahu says, oh, see, Iraq Iran and Al-Qaeda fighting against each other in Iraq. Don't help either side. Let them fight, he said. We played the clip on the show yesterday. And the thing there is, here's Al-Qaeda is much weaker than Iran, and yet Al-Qaeda actually is an enemy of the United States. Iran is only guilty of declaring independence from the United States, which does not make them a legitimate enemy. It makes America a legitimate enemy of theirs, but it doesn't really make them an enemy of the American people. But the bin Ladenites sure as hell are. And, you know, I think that the non-interventionists are absolutely right, and I ain't the only one. There's a lot of people saying that, hey, man, if these guys are as bad as they seem to be, yeah, then we should not provoke them. We can't go in there and kill them all. Trying that only made more of them, ultimately. So, you know what? Let them be Iran's problem. Let them be Maliki's problem. Let them be the Turks' problem. Let them be Assad's problem. But, of course, our government just, you know, they've got to intervene wrongly one way or the other, and probably, you know, more like a few ways, and screw everything up here. I don't know, man. I should shut up about Iraq and get on to this other news, because Peter Van Buren's coming up in a minute, but man, is that something. Oh, and I'm out of time. Well, for this segment, I'm pretty much out of time. Hey, let me say this. I need advertisers on this show. If you own a business, or you're part of a nonprofit type group or something like that, you want to advertise on the show, work cheap. I'll do spots for you, and maybe it'll be worth it. I don't know. I'm Scott at scotthorton.org. And you can talk to me about advertising on the show. I need advertisers, or else there can't be a show. That's just how it works. It's business, you know. All right, back in a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back. Again, Peter Van Buren coming up to talk about Iraq. Will Griggs going to be on the show Thursday. Michael Schwartz tomorrow. I'm going to be on Tom Wood's show tomorrow, although I guess that means it'll be playing on Friday. So that'd be fun to talk with Tom again. So let me get some news knocked out here for you before... it's time to talk with Peter. Here's one at Tech Dirt. Wish I'd saved enough time instead of ranting and raving to just read this whole dang thing for you, but at least I'll tell you about it. DOJ drone memo. AUMF trumps all, and rights are subject to arbitrary revocation in times of war. This is at Tech Dirt. And you know what? I don't know who these guys are, but man, they're pretty good on a lot of stuff, it seems like. TechDirt.com. And, well, I haven't gone through it myself. That's why I wanted to do it live on the show, but I didn't save myself enough time to do it. But anyway, go check this out. Also, of course, Marcy Wheeler has got it all locked down at EmptyWheel.net for you as well. The Alaki memo working thread. And I'm sure there's more now. That's what I have left from yesterday. And then check this one out. This is researchers find and decode the spy tools governments use to hijack phones at Wired.com. And, well, let's see. Newly uncovered components of a digital surveillance tool used by more than 60 governments worldwide provide a rare glimpse at the extensive ways law enforcement and intelligence agencies use the tool to surreptitiously record and steal data from mobile phones. The modules made by the Italian company Hacking Team were uncovered by researchers working independently of each other at Kaspersky Lab in Russia and the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs in Canada, who say the findings provide great insight into the tradecraft behind Hacking Team's tools. The new components target Android, iOS, Windows Mobile, and BlackBerry users, and are part of Hacking Team's larger suite of tools used for targeting desktop computers and laptops. but the iOS and Android modules provide cops and spooks with a robust menu of features to give them complete dominion over targeted phones. They allow, for example, for covert collection of emails, texts, call history, and address books. And they can be used to log keystrokes and obtain search history data. They can take screenshots, record audio from the phones to monitor calls or ambient conversations, hijack the phone's camera to snap pictures, or piggybacks on the phone's GPS system to monitor the user's location. The Android version can also enable the phone's Wi-Fi function to siphon data from the phone wirelessly instead of using the cell network to transfer. The latter would incur data charges and raise the owner's suspicion. Oh, man. So it goes on and on. Here it is at Wired. Researchers find and decode the spy tools governments use to hijack phones. Remember what the NSA said in the Snowden documents? He called you and me zombies. Ha! These American zombies that walk around with these smartphones in their pocket, giving up everything. Oh yeah, download the latest app. Download it, yeah. They got us so bad. And you know what? Not that I, you know, did anything about it, but I think I could actually even prove this. Back in 1993 or 1994, I wrote a thing for a high school paper about AT&T commercials. AT&T or IBM, one of the two. I think it was an IBM commercial. For, you know, one day you'll have a Palm Pilot and you'll be able to sit at the beach and do your work from the beach. And I remember saying, man, that's really cool, right? You don't have to go to the office. You can get some work done from the beach. But, of course, that just means you're making it part of your permanent record forever. Everywhere you go with this thing, whether you're at the beach or anywhere else. We are in the process of giving up any kind of privacy about our moment-to-moment lives that we lead for convenience. I wrote a paper like that in 1993 as a junior in high school, sophomore in high school or something, whatever the hell it was, I don't know, something like that. So, because it's that obvious, right? In fact, that was my first reaction to being told about the internet. And I remember the guy that really explained it to me. He's one of my Facebook friends. His name is Joe. We went to the same high school together. And he explained to me, we were right there in the smoking section. Yeah, I had a smoking section at my high school. And he says to me, he says, yeah, man, internet. You log on with your computer and you can look at everybody else's computer, whatever, you know, that they put up there for you to look at. And I says, yeah, but if you're logging on to this giant network, then that means that they can break into your computer from there and get anything else that you have on your computer is up for grabs. Like, I didn't even understand what a web server was or anything like that. But I just thought immediately, hey, if you're logging on, then that means your ass is wide open. Simple as that. And he said, no, well, that's what all the, you know, then you have people invent programs to prevent that kind of thing and that kind of thing. And, okay, they try, but what do the Snowden documents say? They build in trapdoors and backdoors to break into your system anyway. Hey, we knew that back in 1995. Right? Remember, wasn't it 95? Or no, I guess it was like in 97 or 98 when the story broke about NSA key was part of Windows 95. Huh, there's something in the code here called NSA key. I wonder if that could have anything to do with raping our computers to death. And taking whatever they want. Yeah, we've known all along. I've told y'all this story for, you know, 15 years now. About Rich Texan. Like on The Simpsons, cowboy hat, whiskey, barrel chest, brown jacket, you know, sport jacket, Houston. And, you know, the total caricature of Rich Texan from The Simpsons. That's exactly who this guy was. And he's riding in the back of my cabin. He's drunk as hell, and he's telling me about him and his brother made a telecom down in Houston in the dot-com bubble and how everything is going great. And the NSA came, and they were the scariest sons of bitches he had ever dealt with in his entire life. And they said, you're going to do everything our way, or we will absolutely destroy you. And so, not even a pretense of being nice. As these guys come to talk to some Texas, at least, multimillionaires down in Houston. These old boy Texas boys. NSA walks in and says, all right, here's the name of the game. You're our little bitch. And you're going to do exactly what we say, or you might not live to regret it. And he said that was it. He got out. I hope I'm not giving the guy away his story here. He got out and said he left it to his brother, was tough enough to deal with some stress like that, but he wasn't, and left the company to his brother and got out then. And that, and of course, the story from Bamford's books going back to 1982 or whatever, when the Puzzle Pals first came out, is that the entire telecommunications network of America, since before World War II even, and certainly during World War II, was all built with the NSA, every bit of it, from the ground up. And, you know, the depth and the breadth of it is all built with the national government holding all the cards every step of the way. And of course that's how it is. Every Snowden revelation should just be a reaffirmation for you of what you suspected about just how completely out of control they are. That's right. It's as bad as the worst kook on your block thought it might be. And it's getting pretty bad. And by the way, Greenwald was on Fox News with Shepard Smith and explained that the new one is coming out very soon, imminently, he said, and it'll be all about non-terrorists spied on by the NSA. Political people, he says. Man, I hope it's governors and senators. Less than that, and eh. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Wrapping things up today with Peter Van Buren, author of We Meant Well. I think I got the emphasis right there. We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And he blogs at wementwell.com, formerly worked for the U.S. State Department. Welcome back to the show, Peter. How are you doing?
Scott, it's a pleasure to be back with you.
Good. Very happy to have you back on the show. Been a little while since we talked. And now, so I guess, remind us about your time in Iraq. When were you there? What exactly were you up to?
After more than 20 years at the Department of State as a diplomat overseas, Condoleezza Rice, then Secretary of State, volunteered me collectively and all of the State Department to go to Iraq and complete the reconstruction. We were going there to spend your taxpayers' money building bridges and schools and creating democracy and all the stuff that was necessary to win the war. I was there from 2009 to 2010, and rather than seeing us win the war, what I saw was a colossal waste of money, mismanaged fraud, money being spent that actually harmed the Iraqis and harmed America's national interests. When I came back from Iraq, I went looking for those elusive channels that whistleblowers are supposed to be using. We've heard John Kerry and others talk about that for Ed Snowden. When I couldn't find any of those channels, I decided to write the book that you referenced, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. My whistleblowing efforts almost got me prosecuted by the State Department. It cost me my security clearance. It had me thrown out of the building. It put me on the security watch list for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, fearing that I would somehow, you know, run amok in the cafeteria or something. And the food is quite bad.
Sorry.
Yeah,
the food is quite bad. Didn't mean to laugh out loud over your story there, but.
And eventually, with the help of the Government Accountability Project and the American Civil Liberties Union, including some of the lawyers who are representing Ed Snowden now, mm-hmm. I was able to depart the government and finish my service with the State Department on my own terms. Since then,
so no,
I've been
SWAT raid in the middle of the night, at least. That's good.
Not specifically, no. State Department security people were parked in my neighborhood for a while, the big black car at the end of the block. Mm-hmm. They did make it quite clear to me that they were reading, pre-Snowden, were reading my email, and my finances were looked into. My neighbors were asked questions.
Be specific here, Peter, you weren't releasing classified information. You were just being embarrassing.
Absolutely. The book was is all unclassified. Hate to disappoint any listeners. And in fact, basically, if you had been able to tag along with me in Iraq, you would have seen exactly what I saw, as did probably 20,000 other Americans, none of whom felt the need to speak up, none of whom felt the need to blow the whistle. And so it sort of became incumbent on me to write the book.
There you go. All right, now. So, well, and part of the story, of course, is that the government, like, well, if you ask me, all governments everywhere, but maybe especially this government, is made up of very few men at the top who care about nothing but themselves and their own power. And, you know, I'm a libertarian economics-wise on how to get things done, but these guys won't even try to fund the government institutions that are meant to, you know, turn the electricity back on, get the water flowing. They'd rather extort you to pay extra to have just a little bit of electricity today than build up their own power by providing a decent service, a public utility like electricity, that kind of thing. They still, it's just, they're so mired in corruption, everybody's living completely like crap, and especially the people in the northwest of the country who are on the outs with the state.
What kept occurring to me throughout my Iraq experience, and certainly after I returned to the United States, is why don't we have any of these reconstruction programs here in the United States? If we can spend billions of dollars failing to repair the water and sewer systems in Iraq, why couldn't we spend some of that money here at home? And the answers you get from politicians are, well, we don't have the money. And the answer to that is it very reasonable? Well, where'd you get it for Iraq?
Yeah.
And if we can help people in Iraq or Afghanistan with these things, why can't we help Americans?
Yeah. Well, and of course, why do so many Americans need so much help in the first place? It's because Bush and Alan Greenspan inflated a giant bubble in order to make the war seem free. And now we're all paying the real costs of the Iraq war with our time in the unemployment line. So, you know, all they got to do is, they don't necessarily, from my point of view, well, whatever, leave the money at home in whoever's pockets is certainly better than, you know, pretending to help the Iraqis with it, or like you're saying, trying but failing miserably to help them.
Absolutely. The other cost of the Iraq war is one we're seeing played out right now, and that is since we left Iraq after 9 years of war and occupation without actually resolving any of the issues that we created in Iraq, those issues are going to find their own bottom. It's like water dripping out of a pipe. It's going to run through your walls until it finds where it needs to settle. It's not going to simply go away because you don't want it there.
Right. Yeah, back to the Greenspan bubble. It's a bubble of power. Wherever we intervene, we end up propping up people who don't have that natural level of popular sovereignty, as we call it here. And so we end up creating situations where these questions still have to be resolved and shaken out, which is what's happening right before our eyes.
Absolutely. We kicked over an anthill in 2003 when the United States invaded Iraq. Prior to that, certainly for better or for worse, Saddam kept that country intact. He did it through brutality. He did it through the use of secret police. It was not a pretty picture, but it was a stable picture. The United States removed Saddam, destroyed civil society, disbanded the army, the police, the teachers, the hospitals, everything, and plunged the country into chaos, which is now playing out. Sunni, Shia, Kurd, sure, those are rough ways to define these folks, but they're very crude in the sense that within each of those categories, there are many, many subcategories of tribal alliances, religious alliances, political alliances, warlords who have their own territory to protect, people who want to grab oil. Boy, the list could go on for as much time as we had to read it off. The bottom line is those forces that the United States unleashed are now going at each other. It's a pit bull fight. And rather than staying out of it, which is about the only intelligent thing America can do, we are now plunging right back into Iraq. Troops on the ground, I don't care what you call them, special forces, troops on the ground, drones overhead, airstrikes to come, and suddenly we're at war in a Muslim country once again.
Yeah. Well, and this one that we've been picking on since Jimmy Carter was in power. Obama, I almost called him Bush. Obama, when he gave his
talk,
wouldn't
have been wrong. They're two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. Two wings on the same bird of prey is my preferred expression there. Yeah, now, he said, look, no, you're right, follow-up question asker in the press corps. We do have to avoid mission creep. So that's why our mission is simply to make sure that Maliki wins and that this part of our, you know, northwestern Iraq can never be a safe haven for terrorists. Well, I think he just declared World War II or something, right? He could do that. Based on those premises, he could stay in Mesopotamia in the Levant forever and ever and ever. Marine Corps from now on.
Let's parse that all out. First of all, what's happening in Iraq, you know, that Americans have noticed in the last 2 weeks, it's kind of like how the Americans notice soccer every couple of years when the World Cup comes around. It's like, oh, yeah, is that still a thing? You know, Iraq has been...
Oh, man,
bubbling.
I'm sorry. You know, the bumper music's playing. Can you wrap up this point real fast, or let's just hold it till the break?
Till the break, Scott.
I'm sorry. I asked to, let us wrap up.
No, it's good music. Let's listen.
Didn't give you time. It's Peter Van Buren. He's at the Huffington Post with 10 reasons airstrikes in Iraq are a terrible idea. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Sorry, there are hard time breaks. What are you going to do except botch every segment? What am I going to do except botch every segment? All right, we're wrapping up the show today with Peter Van Buren, formerly a career diplomat at the U.S. State Department, author of We Meant Well, about his role in the attempted rebuilding of Iraq. And we talked a little bit about his whistleblower status and how they went after him, but how he ended up not having to do Kiryaku time, fortunately, or Manning time. But now, when we went out to break, I was asking about the president's statement where he said, well, listen, all we have to do is deny terrorists a safe haven. And so we can do that with a few hundred guys and don't worry about it. And I was saying you could drive the Vietnam War through a loophole like that. And then you were going to say something before the music started playing.
I wanted to parse the president's statement a little bit. First of all, he's talking about denying terrorists a safe haven in northwest Iraq. And with respect to the president, by which I mean disrespect, you know, the Sunni forces have occupied that part of Iraq and controlled that part of Iraq for the last 5 to 8 years, and it has not become a terrorist haven. That's not going to change this week. That's completely disingenuous of him. Second, the idea of sending troops back to Iraq totally steps on, you know, whatever shred of credibility he had from his campaign promises. And third, hey, we're getting the band back together, and the United States will finally find a way to have permanent troop presence in Iraq. Because once you start down these slopes, it's very, very hard to stop. You send in 300 troops, but then you need air support for them. Once you have air support, you need guys who are going to fix stuff. Once you have all those people on the ground, then you've got to protect them. And all of a sudden, as you pointed out, Scott, it's the Vietnam story all over. One guy needs two guys to support him, which needs three guys to protect them. And before you know it, you've got an American military presence in Iraq. The conservatives' wet dream that didn't happen in 2011, but seems to be being set up right now in 2014.
Well, you know, Peter, it's always seemed to me like, you know, after the invasion, it was such a stroke of just, you know, luck or fate or whatever, I guess, on America's behalf, that at least the Al-Qaeda guys were the worst people in the world. Jesus, all they did, going around slaughtering civilians all the time. They provoked a sectarian, well, the Americans helped, too, with their Bada Brigade army and all of that, but for the Sunni side anyway, the Al-Qaeda and Iraq guys helped provoke a civil war that they lost. They all lost and ended up losing Baghdad over. And they were such totalitarians running around, a bunch of foreigners running around Iraq telling the local Sunnis what to do, that they wore out their welcome by 2006, and the tribal and local religious leaders and Baathists all turned on them and marginalized these guys. Couldn't eradicate them, of course, but really marginalized them away. And so they're really, even though for years Bush had created this kind of Wild West gladiator academy out there in the Anbar province and all of that, it had become tamped down, basically, and not by the Iraqi army, but by the local Sunnis. But now the government that America put in power there has been so crappy to the local Sunnis and refused to, you know, allow them to participate in the government or government revenue, really, most importantly, in any substantive way, has led to them now welcoming really Obama's fighters from Syria to come in now and help rid them finally of the Shiite army's presence over their territory. So I wonder whether, you know, really, if it isn't right that this is a safe haven for terrorists. I don't mean to give the war party talking points credibility, except when I happen to agree with them that I think that ISIS really is a threat. And the fact that their new leaders don't get along with Zawahiri isn't really the point. They're exactly the same, except in who's telling who what to do. And from their point, from my imagination of their point of view, it seems like a good idea to draw in the Americans again and to create further crisis over there, to further bog us down, to further recruit new people to their cause and to take their next steps forward. And we've seen, you know, the guy from ISIS killed two Jews at a museum in Brussels a few weeks ago. And there was an American suicide bomber from Florida who went and did a suicide attack in Syria for ISIS not long ago as well. And it seems to me like maybe there really is a threat from these guys. Not that I think that bombing them is the solution, but I kind of don't think maybe it's a good idea to play down just how dangerous these guys really are. If it makes sense to them to attack the West to draw us in, why wouldn't they?
There's truth to all that, and certainly anybody who has ambitions as a terrorist thrives on chaos. But you want to remember a couple of things. First of all, al-Qaeda was not a presence in Iraq before the United States invaded. Al-Qaeda found a home there as a tool to push back against the presence of the United States. The Sunnis needed a way to fight back, and they accepted help where they could find it, which in that case was al-Qaeda. You want to be careful that by attempting to fight terrorism, you don't create the conditions by which more terrorism takes place. The second thing is you want to be careful not to set the house on fire while you're trying to put out, blow out the candle. And the idea is that there's always going to be a suicide bomber who sneaks through here and a terrible thing that happens there. The trick is to keep that all in perspective. If the response to a few isolated acts of terror, albeit terrible things, is to reinsert the American military into a Muslim country, in the long game, you're not going to win. You're going to incite more people. You have to imagine the recruiting potential for all sides to say the Americans are back. They said they were going to leave. 3 years later, here they are again. They're killing Muslims. You know as well as I do that airstrikes and drone strikes are not surgical. We will blow up a wedding party. We will blow up the wrong house. We will kill women and children, the collateral damage that comes with these things. And every one of those acts is going to end up on jihadi social media, and every one of those acts is going to haunt the United States for years and years and years.
It's sort of irresistible logic, though, isn't it, from the Washington, D.C. point of view? What can they do? Not nothing.
Well, you know, if I'm standing in front of a burning building and the only choices available to me are throw the can of gasoline in my hand into the burning building or stand back, well, neither of those are good choices, but standing back is a better choice. And I think that's the thing that's clogging Washington's brain right now, is this incredible desire to do something even when the only things they can do are going to end up going wrong. It's a hard pill to swallow, but sometimes stepping back is really the only thing you can do.
Well, you know, I was just talking with John Neffel from Rolling Stone, who wrote this thing about the drone war in Pakistan and in Yemen. and about just the logic of using drones and how it seems to me like in this instance, it's almost inescapable that they're just going to send in fleets of Reaper drones. And then, so what it comes down to, although they probably wouldn't say it this way when they talk about it in the Oval Office, is if we end up getting American civilians killed in terrorist attacks later, I guess that's the price we have to pay for you know, winning politically now by saying we're doing something about it, and at least we're not putting soldiers' lives at risk when we're just flying Reaper drones around instead of sending in the 82nd Airborne or whatever.
Well, collateral damage, I guess, falls on both sides of the equation, the Iraqi side and the American side. Again, the United States imagines these things as a chessboard, where there's our side and their side, and it's all contained within these checkered squares, and that's completely wrong. When you are striking Sunnis in Iraq, you are risking retaliation by Sunnis everywhere else. These are people who understand guerrilla tactics or insurgent tactics, whatever you want to call it. They don't strike at the strong points. They're not going to be besieging the American embassy in Baghdad. They probe for weak points, and those weak points are not limited to inside of Iraq. And so, yes, when you go to war with these types of forces, you have to understand that it is potentially a global war, or at least a transnational war, and you can't contain it. You're kicking over another anthill. You're getting into the middle of a pit bull fight. Pick whichever analogy scares you the most, and bring the drones home. Let them land. We're done.
Yeah, we should sing a song about that, like the old Pink Floyd rendition of the World War II song, Bring the Boys Home, Bring the Drones Back Home.
Actually, we ought to be careful, Scott. We don't necessarily want to give the government permission to start flying more drones over the United States.
Well, it's too late. That's already on. You give up your empire, you live under it, and we're already living in the future now, I'm afraid. And there's the music. I want to ask you a bunch more things, but thanks very much for coming on the show, Peter. I hope you keep writing about this, and then I can talk to you more about it.
My pleasure. I'll be back, Scott.
Thanks very much, Peter. That's Peter Van Buren, everybody, formerly with the State Department, author of We Meant Well and Ghosts of Tom Joad, a story of the 99%. Look at him at HuffingtonPost.com. 10 reasons to not bomb Iraq. See you tomorrow.